Good morning, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. What a relief it is to be here, brethren and sisters, in the company of the saints, amongst those who appreciate the eternal truths of right that will one day flood the earth. And to have the opportunity to lift our minds and to contemplate those eternal realities, and to leave behind us all the emptiness of man's pursuits, the cares of this life that beset us every day, that we sometimes get caught up in, to leave that from our thinking and to behold the love of God in his Son. It's a great privilege that we have to be able to do that unmolested and to do it with each other in fellowship. Over the past month, brethren and sisters, we've been reading, perhaps not together, but collectively and individually, we've been reading together the words of Deuteronomy. And we've come this morning to read the very last words as part of our daily readings. Deuteronomy chapter 33 and 34 also becomes part of our daily reading today. It's quite interesting because the book of Deuteronomy was recorded at the end of Moses' life when the people were about to go over into the land. The prospect of the kingdom coming very soon was right before them. And in just 1 month, the events that occurred in this book were recorded. And interestingly enough, our daily readings take us almost exactly 1 month to read right through this most amazing book, because it is an amazing book. It's not just another part of the law, but an exposition of it. It's the seedbed of the prophets. It's where Jesus and the faithfuls went to for their strength and comfort, for their understanding of who God was and what he required. And so we find drawn from the pages of Deuteronomy some amazing things that are found and expounded further on in the Old and further into the New Testament. But you know, we've come to the end and read the last words of Moses this morning in Deuteronomy chapter 33. That must have been a very emotional time for him as he'd spent that last month with the people recording all these things and synthesizing for them the very essence of what God required of them and of him. He was an old man, though still strong and with all his faculties. Remarkably, at 120 years of age, his eye was not dim, nor his strength abated. And so it, however, must have been a very sad time for him, knowing that the people were about to go into the land and he himself would not go with them. Because through the period of his life, and by the way, his whole life had been tied up with these people. From a very young child, he'd been conditioned to understand the wonderful purpose of God to redeem his people. And for 120 years, his life had been entangled with the people of Israel and their deliverance. And at three separate occasions, he was ready and prepared to lead those people into the promised land. And on every occasion, he was stopped by the circumstances in his life, by the things that had happened. And now those people would go over and he was to stay. It's not surprising, then, that we find in Moses' words here at the end a great deal of passion, a sense of urgency, and an appeal that's like few others from few other men or women ever recorded in the scriptures. What I'd like you to do this morning, brethren and sisters, is to put yourself in the company of Israel in the plains of Moab. You, along with all of the rest of the company, know that it is a very short time before we're going to cross the Jordan and into the promised land to receive the fruits of the promises that were made to the fathers. You know, brothers and sisters, for us that ought not to be a difficult thing to imagine, because we, interestingly, stand right at the very cusp of those very same things, right on the very same position that this nation that was before Moses, as he spoke on that day, were in. Because we are standing right on the edge of entering the promised rest. Having been called as a special people, a peculiar people, as God said to them and to us. And now having wandered through the wilderness, as we all have, through this great and terrible wilderness, wherein there is no water, and wherein there are serpents all around us, we too have experienced the evil of sin in our environment and the lack of God's word, just as they had, and yet had to faithfully walk through life in preparation for getting to that promised land. And they're now on the borders of the promised land. You know, Moses does three things right at the very end before he departs from them. Come to chapter 29 of Deuteronomy. He gathered the nation together here in verse 2. Moses called all Israel and said unto them, "Ye have seen all that Yahweh did before your eyes in the land of Egypt under Pharaoh and under all his servants, under all his land, and the great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs and miracles, etc." And he goes on and tells them about all the past that had actually happened. There was something urgent here that he wanted to tell them. And at this point, he wanted to reveal to them and to establish the covenant that God was going to make with them. And you know, find that in verse 10. He said, "Stand ye this day, all of you, before Yahweh your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders, your officers, and all the men of Israel, and your little ones, and your wives, and the stranger that's in the camp, and from the hewer of wood to the drawer of water." Every single person in that camp was included, down to the very, very lowest servants, "that thou shouldest enter into covenant with Yahweh thy God, and into his oath which Yahweh thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Neither with you only do I make this covenant, as I do this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before Yahweh God, and also with him that is not here with us this day." So it was looking forward to the time when the covenant of God would be cut with another people that were not standing there this day, not only from within Israel, but beyond the borders of Israel, right down to us. You know, God was going to make a covenant with that people that was unlike the covenant that he made when they were in Sinai. Which covenant at Sinai originally they were party to? Because God said, "You'll do this," and they said, "Yes, we'll do everything you say. We will be obedient." And they could never keep that. But now you notice that the covenant that Moses is foreshadowing is a covenant in which God is involved with them, but he is the party that's going to do everything. You know, brothers and sisters, the covenant that we have entered into with God is just the same. There is no requirement on our part for us to fulfill our part without fail before God will do his. God has before gone ahead in his Son that we've come to remember and has cut that covenant and offers it to us as he was offering it to Israel. But you note the urgency after Moses has gone through all those details. Turn the page to chapter 30 and verse 15. Because here, as he finishes off telling those people how important this was and why they should respond, he says, verse 15 of chapter 30, "See, I have set before thee this day life and good, death and evil. In that I command thee this day to love Yahweh thy God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgment, that thou mayest live and multiply. And Yahweh thy God shall bless thee in the land whither thou goest to possess it. See, brethren and sisters, this passionate appeal on the part of Moses was that they might first of all learn to just love Yahweh because of all that he'd done, and respond to him and walk in his ways for their own good, and he would bless. It was a very, very simple message that he left them. And repeatedly we find this day, Moses was trying to get them to realize it's no good waiting till tomorrow. Whenever you see the importance of this issue, the importance of serving God and of who he is and what he is, make a commitment that day. That's what he was trying to get them to appreciate, to love Yahweh and to walk in his ways. Come down to verse 19. And I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love Yahweh thy God, that thou mayest obey his voice, and thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life and the length of thy days. You know, if Moses stood with us this morning, brethren and sisters, we could almost guarantee he would say nothing different, because we stand in the identical circumstance. We are pulled around by all manner of things in our own lives and in the environment round about us. And we need focusing back on the simplicity of the calling of God to just love our God and obey his voice and cleave to him, that it may be good for us all our days. But you know, Moses was distraught, even though he's telling them this simple message. He's distraught because he knew what those people were like. And he knew the waywardness of the human heart. Come over to chapter 31, verse 26. And he says, take this book and put it in the side of the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God, that it may be there for a witness against you. For I know thy rebellion and thy stiff neck. Behold, while I am alive with you this day, ye have been rebellious against Yahweh. And how much more after my death? Oh, what a tragic thing for him to realize that when he was gone, they would apostatize again and continue in their evil ways, despite the simplicity of the appeal, the simplicity of all that God was asking them to do. Why could they not do that? And so he says in verse 28, gather unto me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears, and call heaven and earth to record against them. For I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside the way which I have commanded you, evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of Yahweh to provoke into anger through the work of your hands. This man who for 120 years had labored to get the people to just see the importance for their own sakes of loving God for all that he'd done and walking in his ways, is now distraught in the last days of his life, because he sees ahead of him a time when some will continue to go their own way. And so he composed a song that we read yesterday in our readings in chapter 32. It's a song we read of in verse 30 of that chapter we just read, 31:30. And Moses spake in the ears of the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they rendered. In fact, the word spoke there can actually be rendered sung, and he may actually have sung it. And we find at the end of end of the song in verse 44 that Moses came and spake all the words of this song in the ears of the people, he and Joshua, the son of Nun. So it may well have been that it was sung. We don't know. But it was something that Joshua and he did together. And this song, which had been composed, was sung. And the theme of which is that God is your rock. Verse 2 of chapter 32. My doctrine shall drop as rain. My speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb and as the showers upon the grass. Because I will publish the name of Yahweh. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, and all his ways are judgment, an isle of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. And there at the foundation of this song is the lifting up of their foundation. This was the one upon whom they could trust. He was trustworthy. He was unmovable. He was righteous. He was perfect in all his ways. They would never have any fear if they based their lives on him. But verse 5 says, oh, but they've corrupted themselves and their spot is not the spot of his children. They had a blemish in them and it meant that they really weren't his children because they didn't have his likeness. They're a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus requite Yahweh, O foolish people and unwise? And so in song, he actually then sets in this song that their waywardness would be there, but calls them back in verse 7. Remember the days of old and consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, go back, find out what God's done. Find out and listen carefully to all. And he relays the goodness and the mighty hand of God and his tender care to Israel. And having done all of that in verse 15, he says, but Jeshurun, a poetical name for Israel, waxed fat and kicked, waxen fat and grown thicker, covered with fatness, and he forsook God which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation, on whom his life should have been built. He forgot and rebelled. Verse 18, of that rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten that God, the God that formed thee. But when Yahweh saw it, he abhorred them because of the provoking of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what the end shall be. For they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. You know, God was really wanting them to establish their lives on him, which required faith in what he'd said and done. You know, the truth isn't complicated, is it, brethren and sisters? God just wants us to believe him, to trust him, and to come to know him and love him. But this people couldn't. And God's drawn into a jealous reaction because of that. And he brings judgments upon them. And all that's included in the song that they were to sing. They were to sing of their own waywardness, in a sense, and their own failure to understand and to appreciate the rock-like figure that he'd given to them. And yet, in the end, amazingly, this song of witness, while it sounds a little negative as we begin, was intended, in fact, as a song of victory and triumph. And that's exactly where it ends, in verse 43. For I find Moses lifting at the end, rejoice, O ye nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants, and he will render vengeance unto his adversaries, but he will be merciful unto his land and to his people. So despite the fact that they went aside and the judgments of God came, all included in this song, finally, God had mercy on them and dealt with the enemies and would bring them in. You know, that must have been a very emotional song for Moses to sing. And we know that it was, because you look at what happened straight after this. As soon as Moses had finished singing this song, in verse 45, Moses made an end of speaking all these words to Israel. He immediately turned to them and said, "Set your hearts unto all the words which I testify unto you this day, which ye shall command your children to observe to do, all the words of this law. For it's not a vain thing for you, because it's your life, and through this thing ye shall prolong your days in the land whither ye go over Jordan to possess it." And he sat down. There was passion and feeling and probably tears coming down his eyes. You know, brethren, we're sitting in exactly the same seat as Israel, with the same kinds of problems. We're made of the same stuff. We feel the pull of all manner of things upon our lives. We need to catch the spirit of this great giant of faith, who for 120 years had patiently borne with all the difficulties in the wilderness, whose life had been given to bringing the people in to their inheritance. We need to catch his spirit, his sense of purpose, because we too are just like Israel, with this same indifference and perhaps even at times hard-heartedness and our own selfish focus that pulls us away and forget God in our affluence. Well, we've got to let this man stir our spirits and our hearts and renew our vision to see the reality. Forget all the vanity and all the silly pursuits that we get involved in, brothers and sisters, just as they did. We've got to learn to just cut through all that stuff and see what is of substance and eternal. Well, look what happened. Verse 48, chapter 32. "And Yahweh spake unto Moses that selfsame day." So Moses has just sung this song and passionately appealed to the people. And the very same day he gets a message: "Get thee up into this mountain Abarim, into Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, which is over against Jericho. And behold the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel for possession, and die in the mount whither thou goest up, and be gathered unto thy people." He's told that very same day he's going to die. Now, he knew he wasn't to go over into the land, but he didn't know it was going to be that day. And having just given them this song, God says to him, "Moses, get ready. You're going up that mount today." And up he goes. But there's one thing that intervenes, and it's what is the actual last words of this man. And they're recorded in chapter 33. And as soon as he finishes saying what he wanted to say in chapter 33, chapter 34 verse 1 says, "And Moses went up from the plains of Moab into Mount Nebo, just as God had said." That same day that he sang the song, he now gave them his last words, which were in the form of a blessing that we've read this morning. You know, Moses was told by God that he had to go up into Nebo and he'd die there. But before he did, he would see the land. But you know, brothers and sisters, in Moses' mind, there was already something that was far more wonderful that anything his eyes would see. It's not to say that when he got on the top of Mount Nebo that he wasn't awed and inspired and thankful for the opportunity God had given him to see all of that land. And perhaps as the angel who came with him showed him all the features of that land, he must have been deeply thankful for that. But there's something else in this man's mind which he wants to share with his brethren. He wanted to share with those people who stood out before him before he went God didn't tell him to do this. This was his own initiative. Chapter 33 is his own initiative. God, it seems, says, Moses, now you've given this song, it's time, you've got to go up Mount Nebo. But he says, no, there's one more thing I want to do. I want to share with this people my blessing and my vision for them. And it's just as relevant for us as it is for them. And so in verse 1, this of chapter 33, this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And notice it's not something that God said, now record this in a book and keep it for posterity. This is Moses' words. And certainly they've been recorded under inspiration. But as we know from Peter, holy men of God were moved by the Spirit. This was the mind of this man that was revealed here and captured by the Spirit for posterity to read and to understand. It was a vision of Israel's future glory. It wasn't just about going over the land and what was going to happen in a few weeks' time when they got there and how they would defeat the enemy here or there and how the land would be flowing with milk and honey. It's not about those things, though. There's an element of that in its superficial application. But it goes beyond that, way beyond. And it shows us where this man's mind was at the end of his life. In fact, probably through much of his life. We read in verse 2, and he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran and came with 10,000s of saints. From his right hand went a fiery law for them. You know, on a casual reading, brethren and sisters, it appears that there's a link there because it's talking about Sinai and Mount Paran and Mount Seir, all of which are sort of areas where the wilderness wanderings had actually taken them at various stages. It sort of sounds on the surface that there's perhaps a reference to what had happened in the past, that God had come from Sinai. But when you look at that very carefully, there is no way that this is talking about something historical, because what it says here has never happened. It never happened before this time in the history of Israel, and it never happened after. And it hasn't even yet happened. So what Moses really was saying here as he began to tell them and to bless the people and to tell them what was going to happen in the future, although he didn't say this is what's going to happen in the future, he just gave them his blessing, we're going to find that this is in fact an amazing vision of the future glory of this nation and how it would come about. Because it says, let's read a bit more carefully, it says Yahweh came from Sinai. The Hebrew has that Yahweh came in from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. What is that talking about? And he shined forth from Mount Paran and came with 10,000s of his saints. And from his right hand went a fiery law for them. Now, twice in that verse it says, unto them or for them. Who is this them? But before we answer that, you'll notice that there's the language of the rising sun, because it says that he rose up from Seir, and it's a term in Hebrew that actually talks about sunrise. And he shined forth from Mount Paran. There's a picture here of immense light shining on a new day. It's a picture of the Son of Righteousness arising. And from his right hand there was a fiery law. And the right hand always stood for the power and the strength of a person. And so here there's a law, a mandate that's backed by fire. This judgment is going to be behind this mandate. And the purpose for that was for them, unto them, this rising of Yahweh is going to occur. Was it coming to destroy them, to bring punishment to them? Well, verse 3 puts us in the picture. Yea, he loved the people. All his saints are in thy hand, and they sat down at thy feet. Every one shall receive of thy words. NIV says, surely it's you who love the people. All the holy ones or the saints are in your hand. At your feet they all bow down and receive your instruction. You notice here it says, all his saints are in thy hand. All his saints are in thy hand. Who's this thy? Well, none other than Messiah coming as king. It's Christ. And the picture here that we've got painted in verses 2 and 3 is of Christ and the multitude of saints, 10,000s upon thousands, coming with him from Sinai and Mount Seir and Paran, from the southern parts of the extremities of the land, right up unto them, wherever they are. And their mandate is that they are able to bring judgments, but they're coming for their good. They're coming for Israel's good. Now Habakkuk, actually picking up the words of Deuteronomy chapter 33, expands. Just come over to Habakkuk for a minute. Habakkuk chapter 3. And here we have a psalm. The whole of Habakkuk 3 is a psalm which Habakkuk recorded in the conclusion of his dilemma in his life, as he came to realize what God was doing and he saw the expansive nature of God's work with his people, and he began to understand really what God was doing. He says in verse 2, O Yahweh, I have heard thy speech and I was afraid. O Yahweh, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of years make known, but in wrath remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. Now, the Hebrew here in Habakkuk chapter 3, in that verse, is in the future tense. There's no doubt about that. Rotherham, RSV, the Septuagint all agree. Brother Thomas quotes those, and he himself translated the start of this verse as a lower will come in from the south, translating the word Teman, which means the south. In fact, in the margin of many Bibles, it'll actually give for Teman the south. And that's where Mount Paran was as well. It picks up the same ideas, though it doesn't actually mention Sinai. It's talking about Paran and the region from down in the south of the wilderness. And then Habakkuk says, Selah. Just stop and think. Why did Habakkuk actually say stop and think when he's only just started to tell us something? Eloah, the mighty one, will come in from the south, and the holy one from Mount Pride. Stop and think and consider, because here is such a remarkable event. Imagine, what were we to think that the mighty one in the earth near Teman and Mount Paran was going to do? Maybe he's wanting his readers to just think about what was going to happen. It wasn't every day that God manifested his glory and his might in the earth like this. And so as he asks the reader to stop and think, perhaps it's also to cast their mind back to what else they know. To go back to link to Deuteronomy chapter 33. Well, let's read on. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light, and he had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. You know, it's exactly the same idea, isn't it? Remember, twice in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 2, it talks about the rising of the sun, the light spreading out across the whole earth, and now we've got his brightness was as the light. And he had horns, and many other versions, the word horns is translated as beams or rays of light, which is what the margin, in fact, in the Authorized Version, in many versions, actually has to say there. So the idea is of great beams of light coming forth from his hand. So his hand was concealing, there was the hiding of his power. His hand was concealing this power for some time, as we know will be the case in the future. And before him, verse 5, went the pestilence and burning coals went forth at his feet. It's just very descriptive, figurative language, isn't it? And he stood and measured the earth, and behold, and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. It's just a fantastic picture of all this imagery. It goes on down through as Habakkuk sees the combined forces of Christ and all the multitudinous saints that are with him in absolute glory and power, marching through to deal with their enemies. But, verse 13 says, thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for salvation with thine anointed. Thou wentest the head of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation under the neck. Thou wentest the rosh, it is in Hebrew. And so the saints will go forward with Christ to actually wound the head of the great power that comes against them and deliver, snatch from their hand, as it were, the people of God, the Israel, whom he loves, and bring them salvation. You know, that's what Moses saw, you know. And that's what he wanted to tell the people about. Here he is standing, his last word, the last thing he wanted to tell them was this vision that he had in his mind of when Christ would come with all the saints, and he would come with such power and glory that he would just vindicate his people and come for them. He looked across that assembled multitude of people to whom he'd just sung the song, brothers and sisters. And he told them about their waywardness. He told them the need to rest on their rock. But he knew that they would go away. But now, as he speaks to them and gives them this final blessing, he doesn't focus on their waywardness, on their frustrations, their weaknesses. Because before him he saw Christ coming. He saw him moving to save his people in a far distant day. And Habakkuk later picked up that same vision and expanded it in his time. Come back to Deuteronomy chapter 33. You know, we know this is absolutely how Moses was seeing this. Because at the end of this blessing, he says in verse 28... Israel shall then dwell in safety alone. The founder of Jacob shall be upon the land of corn and wine, and also his heavens shall drop down dew. It's a time of idyllic peacefulness and tranquility where Israel's finally established and have been saved by the hand of Christ and the saints. Look at verse 27. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath the everlasting arms, he that shall thrust out the enemy, he shall thrust out the enemy before thee, and shall say, destroy them. You know, in verse 27, the word eternal there is very rarely ever translated in the Old Testament eternal. It's more frequently just translated east, in the direction east. And Brother Thomas renders that verse, the mighty ones of the east are thy refuge, and underneath the arms of the Olam. And so what we're really being told here is that, yes, they were truly saved. The mighty ones of the east, the kings out of the sun's rising that are, we know about from Revelation chapter 16, which are the Christ and the saints, the mighty ones of the east are thy refuge. And that's exactly what happens here. And what... precisely what Moses saw, and underneath are the everlasting arms, or the arms of the age. And the arms, the strength of the age, are going to be the saints. You and I, brothers and sisters, are going to be those everlasting arms, the arms and the strength of the age that's going to move in and support and pick up Israel and plant them in their land again. And it's going to be a support and a comfort to all those who are in need throughout that whole age. Verse 26 says, there is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in help, and his excellency in the clouds. And it's a picture again just like the cherubim. So this, no doubt, at the end is talking about Christ and the saints and all the work that they were going to do to establish the nation in their place in the land, the cherubic host in glory. But in between those things, we have all the details, and it's not our purpose this morning to look at all the detail. We'll just look at a couple of things just before we conclude. But what does emerge here, brethren and sisters, amongst all this detail that was given to each of the tribes is something that is looking forward into their future restoration and glory, not just something that was going to happen the next year as they moved into the promised land at that point, but something that was far more transcending and went way beyond that. And it's fascinating to see the picture. You know, there's almost nothing bad said at all in all of this. So the blessing that lands here is very different in character to the song which Moses had sung to them as a song of witness. Because here we find, in summary, that Reuben is going to live and Judah will conquer and Levi shall teach judgment and Benjamin shall dwell with the beloved of Yahweh. And Joseph shall triumph and reap the blessings of God. And Zebulun and Issachar will rejoice and offer sacrifices of righteousness. And God shall administer justice through Gad. And Dan shall judge in strength. And Naphtali shall experience the satisfaction and the blessings that come from God's hand. And Asher shall be fruitful and enjoy abundance. You know, brothers and sisters, you know what those tribes were like. You know what their original parents were like in their early days. And how those tribes played out and their apostasy, how they had played the harlot with the nations and their gods. And now this amazing picture that Moses saw at the end of his life, despite having dealt with those people for 120 years, was this picture of amazing abundance and glory and blessing. This wayward nation, faithless, would be transformed nationally, not individually, nationally. And here is the wonder of God's purpose that Moses appreciated. The wonder of God's purpose through all ages, brethren and sisters, is that he has a purpose. He desires to bring us out that he might bring us in. He didn't bring Israel out to make them die in the wilderness. Some did because of their own faithlessness. But his desire is to bring them out that he might bring them in. And he brings us out, brothers and sisters, and has called us for exactly the same purpose, that he might bring us in. You know what Paul said in Hebrews 4? He said, talking about that generation, some of whom were faithless, he said, the bottom line is that some must enter. And God's word will not return void to him. And his hand is mighty, and it will save, and his purpose will be revealed. And Moses, right at the end of his days, lifts his eyes across the nation, and he tells them about his vision, about all that God is able to achieve if man isn't, and how he will pick up people and the weak, and he will turn them into the strong, not because of their own characteristics, but because individuals would learn to trust and rest and believe. You know, even Reuben, the tribe and their father, both failures. Reuben lost the right of firstborn because of adultery and his own folly. And he became a type of the whole nation who themselves, through spiritual adultery, lost all their privileges as a nation. And yet in the end, Reuben's there. Despite all the setbacks, God is able to turn it all around. And Moses prays for their increase. What a man! What an incredible picture he had, and how much trust did he have in God's revealed purpose? Of course he knew Reuben would be there. And Judah, look at Judah in verse 7. And this is the blessing of Judah. He said, hear Yahweh, the voice of Judah, and bring him unto his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and be thou an help unto him from his enemies. You know, when Christ and the saints come, Judah will be in distress in the latter days when Gog comes down upon the mountains of Israel. We know that from Zechariah chapter 12. Judah will be in distress, and they will cry, and they will be heard. And the mighty hand of that great throng of saints riding upon the heavens, coming for his people, will pick them up. Be thou a help and he will. And Moses saw that vision, saw the characteristics of these tribes and embedded them in here. But you know, brothers and sisters, there's a much wider application in these blessings, because in very many of them, the focus is all on Christ. You see, Moses started with Christ in glory coming with all his saints to save his people, and ends by saying, this is why they are now like they are. Because, as we read in Colossians, it's by him. Christ is the centerpiece of everything. It's the centerpiece of God's whole purpose. And because of him, all things were created that are in heaven and in earth, visible and invisible, said Paul. Whether they be thrones or dominions, principalities or power, all things were created through him and for him. And on account of him, all things exist. And Moses knew that. That's remarkable. And these blessings turn to center on Christ. Take one example in verse 8. And of Levi he said, let Thummim and Urim be with thy Holy One, whom thou didst prove at Massah, and whom thou didst strive at the waters of Meribah. Now, some of these verses are a bit enigmatic, but when we untangle them, Brother Thomas says, let thy Thummim and Urim be of the man, the Holy One. And that might not help at all, you might think, to understand. But remember this, that the Urim and Thummim was the means by which God communicated his will to his people. And it was in the hands of the Levitical priests, the high priest, the Levitical high priest, and this now spoken to Levi, they are told, the Urim and Thummim, let that now be with the Holy One, whom you did prove at Massah and Meribah. Now, Paul tells us that that rock was Christ and focuses our attention on that. But here, Moses, hundreds of years before, was looking at all of those circumstances and could say, the Urim and Thummim is going to transfer onto the Holy One who is yet to come. It will not stay with Levi. You know, the mediatorship and the communion of God's will is going to pass to another priesthood, to the Christ who is of the order of Melchizedek. And there's still going to be a role for the priests, for the Levites, verse 10, and they shall teach Jacob thy judgments and Israel thy law, and they shall put incense before thee and whole burnt sacrifice upon thine altar. For them there will still be a work to do, but here the focus is on the centre, the Lord. And the priesthood is going to be removed from them and they will still minister. But Christ will be right at the centre and the core. And I suppose in the blessing to Joseph, we have the highlight of this. It's the longest of all the blessings. And we don't need to look at it in any detail, but just let's read and get the sense of what it's saying. Verse 13, and of Joseph he said, blessed of Yahweh be his land, with, as it probably should be, with the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth it beneath, and with the precious fruits that are brought forth by the sun, and with the precious things brought forth by the moon, and for the and with the chief things of the ancient mountains and the precious things of the everlasting hills, and with the precious things of the earth and the fullness of thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and upon the top or the crown of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. And there in the end, this amazing panorama of blessings that in every shape and form here described by all those characteristics are going to rest on Jacob, on Joseph, and on the head of him who was separate from his brethren. And we know Joseph was one of the most amazing types of our Lord Jesus Christ. But in the end, the true firstborn, the true priest, the true Nazarite was not Joseph, but our Lord, and through him the blessings of all are going to flow to all the world. And his strength is going to go forward, as it says in verse 16, 17. And he's going to push and put the nations in their place, and 10,000s of Ephraim and thousands of Manasseh are going to be behind him. The saints are going to be there. and bring about the will and purpose of God. Then we come back to the finale in verse 26 and 7. There is none, says Moses after he's given them blessings. There is none like unto the ale of Jeshurun, the upright one, and now the nation is for the first time, who rideth upon the heavens with thy help in his excellency in the sky. The mighty ones of the east are thy refuge, and underneath are the arms of the age. Thou hast thrust out the enemy before him and said, destroy, and Israel shall finally dwell safely. The fountain shall be there, and the heavens shall drop down dew. What an amazing picture. This is Moses' vision, verse 29. Happy art thou, O Israel. Who is like unto thee, O people saved by Yahweh, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thine excellency? And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee. They shall be subdued, the margin says, and you will tread upon the high places that once they owned. Who is like unto thee? Who indeed, O Israel? You know, brethren and sisters, the only people like that nation, so blessed, so privileged, are you and I. And more so. We have an opportunity by their faithlessness to come to know their God. And shortly, he will bruise Satan under our feet and redeem his people and make us inherit the high places of the earth. You know, brothers and sisters, amidst all the things that just happen in our lives every day, the trivial things, the unimportant things that sometimes we blow up in our minds, what reason have we to be sad? Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee? None have such reason to be glad as those that are reconciled to God, says our hymn. And what a tremendous sense of gratitude we ought to have. And how unworthy we are as we come now to think about the one on the table who is not only the Redeemer but the executor of all God's will. You know, what we've just looked at very briefly was the key to Moses' own faith amidst all the frustrations that he experienced in the camp of Israel. Because not only did he believe God and love him, he lifted his mind and his hope to the future, and we've seen his active vision. He didn't see something just passive, something that was black and white on a page. He saw a mighty host moving. He saw them redeeming people. He saw them walking upon the high places of the earth. He saw all the blessings flowing. And in his mind, this was a reality. And as soon as he'd finished those words, he walked down through the people and out of the camp, through the edge, the extremities of the camp, and out of sight, and up Mount Nebo. And there God showed him the glory of all the land that he longed to go to. But as he viewed that, brothers and sisters, what did he see? Yes, he saw from the north to the south, the east to the west. He saw that with his eyes. But what did he see by faith? Because in his mind, he saw the cherubic host sweep in from the south, clutch his people in that very region from the hand of the enemy and establish them within glory in the millennial age. And as the light faded on Nebo that night, he closed his eyes in sleep. It was that vision, brothers and sisters, that carried him all his days, 120 years, bearing with the weaknesses of his brethren, bearing with the frustrations of this life. But herein was the victory. As John says, even our faith. And for him, it was that faith that had generated that vision that carried him beyond. And he's left it with us to leave so that we might read too. And in the end, he leaves us with that timeless message. Believe the Eternal One and trust him and love him. And he will transform us now and guarantees to bring us in and deal with our enemies and put behind all the things that worry us now and make us walk in a day soon to come upon the high places of the earth forever.